cliffcentral.com. A lot of people, I think, are interested, even in an African context alone, are interested in who their ancestors are. They care about where they come from. And if you think about it, exactly a half of who you are is determined by your nature, what's in your genes, the people who make you, right? And another half of you is your nurture, your experiences, the resources you're given when you're a child and the way you're raised and the people you get to mix with.
Yeah.
But it's half and half, roughly. And very few of us spend a lot of time looking into where we come from. Too few of us, if you ask me, spend their time trying to find out what sort of people made them. But I am fascinated by genealogy, as you know. And the person who got me interested in this is he's a distant relative of mine, but he's also a friend for many, many years. Conrad Penny is here with us this morning. How are you, Conrad?
Very well, Gareth. Good morning.
And thank you for sending me all those charts. Conrad, we were just talking, is descended from King Edward III in 28 different lines. Do you need to turn that up?
No, I can hear.
There we go.
No.
28 different lines, right?
As of this week, 29. It's an endless task.
It never stops. And you have to do, if you're serious about genealogy, you have to do a lot of research and you have to spend a lot of time being very meticulous about detail. And because a lot of this is historical and quite old, it's hard to find these details in an irrefutable fashion, in an irrefutable form.
Yeah, that's the secret of genealogy, is that you never, ever accept something as a given until you can prove it absolutely conclusively. Because if you don't, the whole basis of your study falls apart and the information is not treated with respect.
And usually that involves birth certificates and marriage certificates and actual documents.
Yeah, fortunately, I have a very good genealogist who does all this for me. May I give his name?
Of course.
Don MacArthur, excellent fellow. He keeps on finding another line. He's found not all 28 of them, but certainly the last 20 of them. We knew we had this Plantagenet descent. And as soon as you plug into one Plantagenet line or one royal line, immediately it opens up a gateway to many others, not just English royalty, but European royalty.
And eventually you end up, because there are almost 7 billion people on Earth today. There weren't ever at any stage 7 billion people.
Correct.
We all have eventually an infinite number of ancestors in terms of you have two, your parents each have two, and so you double it.
They compound. If you go back 20 generations, which is 500 years, each of us has over 1,042,000 ancestors. That assumes that there's no common crossover, which of course there is, because the numbers were so limited 500 odd years ago.
So we're all related to ourselves many times.
Exactly. But at some point, you might even be your own grandpa.
Now.
But I think you'll find a lot of people who have no knowledge of their ancestry will probably find they also have a royal blood.
Yeah.
It's simply a case that they haven't got the records to prove it.
And ultimately, that we're all actually related to each other, if you just go far enough away from the origin.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure about that. You and I have discussed this in detail before.
There are probably some people you don't want to be related to. But the interesting thing about genealogy is not only do you discover these grand ancestors, but you also discover scoundrels and
absolutely.
And misfits and liars and pirates and evildoers and even, God forbid, actors and actresses.
Well, that's exactly what we've got. Yeah. And apparently Elvis Presley was supposed to have had some Plantagenet blood. And I remember when that lovely girl, now the Duchess of Cambridge, came to the fore, Katie Middleton, and they called her Katie Middle Class, and I thought that was very unkind. And I said, she stands so beautifully and got these fine thin wrists and fine thin ankles, and she stands with pride. Don't be unkind about her. You'll probably find there is some blood. And of course, particularly now that she's in the royal line and she's produced children who are going to be successors to the royal line, they've naturally, the College of Arms and other people have found that she does have descent from Edward III as well.
Huh.
Wow.
Now,
They had to do that, of course.
You attended, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you this morning. Conrad has many interests, and he's got many hobbies, and he's done many interesting things in his life, which is why I'm always interested in having a talk to him. And I thought we should share that with everyone else today. But there is a curious situation that happened in the royal line in the 1400s. You mentioned the Plantagenets. That was the surname of the English royal family until about the late 1400s, and then the Tudors took over under Henry the VII, and they took the throne by victory on the field of battle.
It was a very ugly victory.
Yeah, and just to give
victory.
Just to give everyone the preceding history to that, the Plantagenet family descended from William the Conqueror, who was a Frenchman who landed and conquered England in 1066. They remained in possession of that land as feudal overlords until about the late 1400s. But this was a family of King Richard the Lionheart, of King Edward III, who established a sort of court of Camelot and the Knights of the Garter and all Absolutely. Kinds of other things that are integral to English history. And there were the Wars of the Roses, which were the fights between the various cousins in that family tree. And this is how it ended, with the Battle of Bosworth. King Richard III, who they maligned in history as a hunchback, they said he was an inferior sort of person, a liar, a twisted, nasty person who murdered his own nephews in order to secure the throne for himself.
You want me to comment on that?
Is any of that true?
Look, as I heard you say earlier, the victor always writes the history. Mm. And it's more than interesting that there are a group of academics who believe that Shakespeare himself might not have been Shakespeare, and they're known as the Oxfordians. And in fact, John, 13th Earl of Oxford, John de Vere, 13th Earl of Oxford, was the leader of Henry VIII's, at that time, Henry Tudor's army at Bosworth Field in 1485. And it wouldn't be surprising if his grandson, using the nom de plume of Shakespeare, would have obviously been on the side of the Tudors. But the Tudors were rotten people. They were dreadful people. And in fact, Henry Tudor, I'm sorry to say, was way outside the natural line of succession.
He was a bastard, in fact, his only claim to royal descent was through his mother.
French.
Right. And through his mother's very tenuous links to John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, the second son of King Edward III.
All right. Exactly.
This may be minute detail to some people, but for some it'll be interesting. Yeah. So he meets Richard III on this field, but Richard III isn't really this monster that they've portrayed him as.
He certainly isn't. And we're busy compiling a lot of information about him. I'm not really at liberty to say that we're going to put together a book.
Yeah.
But I've been pushed into this position whereby, not with a view to exonerating Richard, we're simply putting together facts, both for and against his life, and let the reader decide. So we've come across a lot of evidence which proves that he was not the man that people have accused him of being. We're busy compiling all of the book references that are available. I have engaged and are working with an English-trained historian here on this particular task. His name is David Emerson. And it's very interesting that there are, of course, a number of things which we can't at this moment prove that he was innocent about. The issue about which he was the most famous or infamous was the disappearance of the princes in the Tower. He came to the throne because they were declared illegitimate anyway, because his brother, Edward IV's birth itself was not exactly what we'd call kosher. He was referred to by remote members in the family as Blayborn, which is after an archer in Rouen in France, who is supposed to have had an affair with his mother.
Isn't this exciting, Mubs? Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of history that people love, because it's got affairs, it's got murder, it's got... I mean, this is a real...
Look, chastity belts weren't around for no reason.
All right.
Okay, so
Richard III.
Richard III's brother, who had been king, Edward IV himself was not totally legitimate, or his ancestry hasn't been completely proven.
And this is the man from whom as well as the Tudors, the current queen descends. All of this is important. Why is this important? Because it means that that 90-year-old woman who sits on the throne in Buckingham Palace
great
now.
Great lady.
Sure, but perhaps in terms of her lineage,
in terms
not
of her
the
lineage,
best person to be
she
there.
Descends from the Tudors, and the royal line would descend from the proper Plantagenets, who were, in fact, through Margaret, Countess of Salisbury, who in turn was the daughter of George, Duke of Clarence, who in turn was the older brother of King Richard III. He had been attained by his brother, or half-brother as the case may be, Edward IV, when he tried to take the throne, aided and abetted by his father-in-law, Richard, Earl of Warwick, the kingmaker. And for that reason, he was attained and, in fact, drowned in a butt of Malmsey.
Which means what?
Mulberry wine.
Drowned in mulberry wine.
Yeah, because he was apparently because of his blood. They asked him how he'd like to die.
Huh.
We've investigated that, and even that hasn't been confirmed. He might have been stabbed a couple of times before that. But his two children, by his wife Warwick, this is now George, Duke of Clarence's two children, were Edward, who became Earl of Warwick, and his daughter was Margaret, Countess of Salisbury. She was the last
Plantagenet.
The last living Plantagenet. She was beheaded on Tower Hill. I don't have the exact date. I could pull it out of a piece of paper if you know that I've got
it. Nice,
here.
Gruesome murder, that one.
A very unkind, unjust murder.
Basically,
she
remember,
was a lady,
Mabs, I told
and she
you
was
about
the rightful one to the crown after her brother, who, of course, had been taken out by Henry Tudor himself. Henry Tudor was very threatened, felt very threatened by his tenuous succession to the crown by accident, by battle at Bosworth on the 22nd of August 1485. He felt so insecure that he spent the equivalent of £2 million today on the sound of something.
You don't need it. You don't need them. You can
£2 million today on his clothing. You could believe anybody could spend the equivalent of £2 million today.
You could spend that much in your clothes.
Challenge accepted, yes.
So, Conrad.
So, just to say, his position was very tenuous. The rightful heir was King Richard's nephew, Edward, Earl of Warwick, and he wasn't eligible for the crown at the time of the Battle of Bosworth because his father's estates had been attained. And for that reason, was kept in the Tower as a prisoner.
Now, you attended a ceremony, because for a lot of people this is difficult to follow, but you attended a ceremony where Richard III was buried last
Correct.
Year.
A year before.
Year before last.
26th of March, 2015.
They found his remains under a car park in Leicester.
Yes, he was the king who put the king into parking.
And they dug him up, and they decided this could be Richard III. They did lots of DNA tests. Apparently what they needed was living relatives.
Yes.
So now, people who they could prove were related to him.
Correct.
In order to put the DNA together.
I put my DNA forward with a view to assisting them in their searches, knowing that they would take me seriously on the basis that my records were recorded at the College of Arms in London, and if anybody wanted to query the allegation or the claim of this descent, it could be verified there. As it transpired, they couldn't use my DNA because it's very complicated when the DNA changes from male to female per generation to take the X chromosome, which then transmutes into a Y, which means through the father's line, or the other way around, normally the X and then the Y and then normally the X all the way down. The only reliable way that they could establish the parentage of Richard was to take his sister Anne of York through the mitochondrial DNA, that's the female DNA, and plot down a chap called John Ashdown Hill, I think his name was, plot down from Anne of York, sister of George, Duke of Clarence and Richard, daughter, mother to daughter, all the way down to the present, and that way they ended up with two people, one called Michael Ibsen and the other called Wendy Duldig. Now, these too were treated with enormous pomp at the time of the ceremony. Not that I was badly treated. I was treated beautifully. Very well treated.
So who are these two people? Should we know them?
Well, that's the point. They, in fact, are of the same descent through the female line. But in terms of succession, they're the furthest away from succession, based upon how things were. That goes back to Margaret, Countess of Salisbury, who herself was a female and possibly going to be queen after Maud Matilda, who you would know about, Gareth, was in the running to be queen, and she did that deal with King Stephen after William the Conqueror, who we called William the Bonkerer. But going back to the succession, Margaret, because of the power that she had and the fact that her blood was so royal and so pure, was seen to be a true threat
to
the English throne, and that's why they killed her. The term was extirpated. Henry VIII and his father, Henry VII, went out of their way to extirpate all Plantagenet lines to make damn sure there were no successors.
So when
and
I
it serves them damn right that they died out themselves.
No, well, they did.
Almost.
They almost did.
By remote, yeah.
So these Tudors tried to cover up a murder. They tried to cover up a very shady history. And they found Richard III. And the point of this is that you went to this ceremony. It was a royal burial.
Yes.
But the Queen doesn't want it to be seen to be too important, does she?
It's more than interesting, Gareth, that the whole event was played down. Although the Duke of Gloucester was there, remembering that Richard himself, King Richard III, had been Duke of Gloucester before he became king. And although Sophie Wessex, the Countess of Wessex, the Queen's daughter-in-law, were present, nice girl, the point is that they actually kept away, they kept themselves away, and it was more than interesting that this whole thing was played down. The bones, when they were brought into Leicester, where it had been agreed by competition that his bones would be interred in Leicester Cathedral, but when the bones were brought into town, the streets were packed with people because it was on a Saturday. And the actual reinterment of the bones took place in the middle of winter on the 26th of March, one of the most bitterly cold days I've ever experienced in my 66 years. Bitterly cold weather on a Thursday. What king is buried on a Thursday? I mean, in the middle of winter, there was no significance of the date. If they'd used the Battle of Bosworth Field, I mean, the bones had been lying there for 530 years. It wouldn't have mattered if they had actually kept the bones in a box for a couple more months until the actual event, 1485, in fact, was 530 years. In that year that the battle took place, they could have waited a few months and had a huge ceremony. But the whole thing was played down. And you know, as well as I do, why this was. All the heralds were wearing only mourning coats. There were only two heralds there. In fact, the Lancaster herald recused himself. York herald was there and Garter King of Arms was there. All the Bosworth peers only wore mourning coats. No ceremony at all. No bright colors. No flashing of flags or anything of that order. It was played down specifically because they didn't want to draw attention to it.
Sounds like a minor funeral of some bureaucrat. Doesn't sound like a royal funeral.
Well, I mean, it was a very grand affair. There were only allowed 200 visitors, guests, outside the official people who were there due to the restrictions on the size of the cathedral. There were only 200 guests. And what they decided to do was to say, and I wasn't one of those I'm talking about now from the public were allowed to attend, but limited to 200. Typically English, they said 100 of those 200 must come from Leicester because this is a burial in our county, in our city. They must come from Leicester. The others can come from anywhere in the world. Fortunately, I didn't have to go into this ballot system and apply because I'd already been invited to attend. So it was quite special. They'd had 14,500 applications for people to.
So there was considerable interest.
Huge interest. But this thing was played on for the reasons that I've given you. Although it was a grand affair. There's absolutely no doubt about that. It was a very grand affair.
If the if the Queen's descent is from the Tudors, and there are superior claims from more senior Plantagenet bloodlines, who should have been the king if we could roll out history as it is now, okay, without changing any of the subsequent things that would have happened. Okay. And of course it would have turned out differently. But who is the senior heir to
the Plantagenet line?
Yeah.
It's Simon Abney Hastings.
Who's that?
Who's an Australian. yeah,
and King Simon.
Just King Simon he was. But interestingly enough, I understood that his application was discouraged. He wanted to attend the service and it was discouraged.
He wasn't there?
He was not there, but he wanted to come.
Huh.
So that's a bit of interesting detail.
What does...
Now, he, like you, Gareth, and like me, descends through Margaret of Countess of Salisbury, who is, we know, is the last living Plantagenet. That is the true Plantagenet line. And the Yorkist line, although it was a very short-lived one, was the truest of the two because the Yorkists descended from two of the four sons of Edward III who had issue that lasted. There were six sons of Edward III. Only four of them had issue that lasted into, you know,
modern
times. And the Yorkists came from two of those, a combination of Edmund of Langley, who was Duke of York. Sorry, Edmund of Langley, who was Duke of...
yeah, he was York. Edmund of Langley.
Edmund of Langley was Duke of York.
And Lionel of...
Lionel of Antwerp, who was Duke of Clarence.
Okay, this might be... Have we lost you, by the way? Is anybody still following this? Because this can become complicated. Honest.
I'm now on the Australian Simon. I'm sort of there.
Are you off the air now?
No, we're still on
the air.
No, we're still...
All right.
This is how we talk.
What really makes this interesting, why they use the mitochondrial DNA, is because... Going back on the Latin term, pater semper uncertum, father never sure.
Excuse me, just one more time.
Yeah, this is important.
Parde semper uncertum. Father always uncertain or never certain.
You never know who the mum has been.
Now, on that particular basis, the genealogist...
In 2017, we call that Jerry Springer.
That's about like that.
We call that a Jerry Springer show. Yeah.
So the genealogist at Leicester University with Professor Schurer, who is a brilliant fellow, he had a Canadian woman, marvelous girl called Turi King. And they've worked out that there's infidelity of between 1% and 2% per generation.
So
the infidelity will come from the male because the mother's always certain.
It's a small likelihood, but that means that every generation...
But if you multiply it by 20 generations, there's a 20 to 40% chance that you're not who you think you are. How about that?
Yeah.
So this is why the DNA becomes quite critical.
And the reason the mitochondrial DNA is important because in the female line only, that DNA is separate. You know, inside your cell, you have a cell. You have all your chromosomes in the nucleus. Those are what determine all your characteristics. Then there are these little energy producing organelles, they call them, inside of a human cell.
Okay.
And those, they suppose, are actually separate organisms that eventually found their usefulness in being part of the animal cell, the human body cell. And that DNA is not changed down the female line because if you think about the egg, this is probably a bit technical, but this is interesting.
Okay.
So the egg cell, the egg cell that is inside a woman's ovaries is the cell that hosts the baby.
Yes.
The sperm, the sperm comes in and drops off half of its chromosomes, which, or half of its DNA, which then forms those chromosomes, which then gives you all your characteristics and identity. But the rest of the cell is purely female to female to female to female. Yeah. So that DNA is the one that they use to trace where our ancient Eves come from.
Correct.
Where the different...
And Richard. I mean, even as fundamental as Richard now, they proved who he was by virtue of the fact that they followed the mitochondrial DNA of his sister down to modern times and found these two people who had a mitochondrial DNA that matched the bones, his bones, the DNA of his bones. That's what proved that he was who he was.
And isn't it incredible that we can do this now? Of course, this was impossible 50 years ago.
It's going to revolutionize genealogy and a variety of things. Revolutionize.
So I started off by saying how it's interesting and sort of important to know where you come from because that's the stuff that is you that you actually can't do anything about. That's just what you have.
Correct.
You can change the way you behave.
Mm-hmm.
You might be able to acquire more or less resources. You might be able to educate yourself. You might be able to improve or make yourself worse. But these are things that are immutable almost. They're inside of you. They are inherited.
Whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, Sia, we'll talk about, you know, the interesting stuff that everybody's family has. And everyone's family is interesting if you bother to look at it. Mm. You know, we do have this interest in our ancestors in Africa.
Of course.
Everybody is interested in where their ancestors come from, what their ancestors did. And we've got some very, very curious bloodlines in this country, especially. But it's fascinating because it's peculiar only to you. There isn't anyone.
And it's a combination. It's this unique combination that makes it. You. Yeah.
So it is interesting, Conrad. Yeah. And this is how you got into this.
Well, I was interested as a boy. I was told a couple of unusual things about our ancestry, which intrigued me. And found papers that confirmed what I was told, and I then delved further.
Yo, where do you even begin? So what sort of papers started you off?
Well, my father told us that we came from Charlemagne, who was the emperor of Europe in the 700, approximately. Mm-hmm. That's over 1,400 years ago. And that started a curious intrigue. And then I knew that my mother had some exotic blood, and that, in fact, created more intrigue. And from about the age of 12, I became fascinated by this because the odds change at every single discovery. As I said, you personally have over 1,042,000 ancestors over a period of only 500 years. What's intriguing is when you go back earlier than that.
More than a million ancestors over, in 500 years.
Yeah, yeah. You've got over a million people that have made you. But when you go back, there's so few.
Just if any one of those, sorry to interrupt you, Conrad. If any one single mating hadn't happened, I hate to use the term mating, but this is what it is.
Accurate.
If any one of those mates had died before they'd got to mate with the other person, you would not be you and you would not be here.
Yeah. And that's why this succession is so important. It was always a struggle for who was the rightful heir to control, in those days, the crown. Is all based upon succession. You're right. The primogeniture. I'm the eldest son of that king, therefore it's my right to be the next king. Mm. That's why they bumped each other off from time to time, poisoned each other, arranged for them to be killed. Savage behavior, a lot of them. Absolutely savage behavior. But what is interesting, going back on the Abney Hastings line, that's the Earl of Lordoon, Simon Abney Hastings, the Australian.
King Simon.
King, is that...
I know him. I'll send him this podcast.
Yeah, send. He'll be amused by it.
Yeah.
It would be interesting if he could confirm what I told you, that his visit was discouraged. The Lancastrian line, they've now found another level of infidelity to the point that John of Gaunt might not have been the daughter of Philippa, who was Edward III's wife.
The son of Philippa.
The son. He was the son of Philippa.
Yeah. They say that might
who was the wife of Edward III, and they're saying that there's a chance that the whole Lancastrian line
isn't actually
legitimate to this day.
These people had so many children by so many women.
Yeah,
these kings. It's amazing that anybody knows where anyone's from.
Well, that's the whole thing about blue blood. People say, "Oh, blue blood." Of course, blue blood comes from a lack of white corpuscles.
Oh, is this why they say the term blue blood?
Interbreeding is caused by a reduced level of white corpuscles in your bloodstream.
Huh.
And that's what makes your blood darker. And that's where the term blue blood comes from. But the intriguing thing about the royalty of Europe is that they had the power, the royalty and the aristocracy, to import wives. Catherine of Aragon, the English were importing French, Italian, Portuguese, and Spanish girls over all these years, bringing in fresh blood all the time. So it's a bit of a misnomer or a bit of a myth about blue blood, because you would have had a bunch of peasants living in a village and they were log jammed in that area. So it was rather like a cesspool, and they had to only breed in this village because they didn't have the power to walk the 4.5 miles or 6.5 miles to go to the next village. They may have been attacked on the way anyway. So they were also interbreeding on their own, but amongst a bigger number of people.
Yeah.
There's also the suggestion that the blue blood comes from the sallow skin, but there's nothing sallow about your and my skin. But the
sallow?
The sallow in terms of it being slightly darker than normal.
Ooh,
and that's
can
what
I
makes
call myself that, sallow?
You can say sallow.
I am sallow.
Now, Sia has an interesting ancestry,
too. That's what makes your veins look blue. you know, when you put, when you open up your hand or show your wrists.
Sia has interesting ancestry. His full surname is Sangweni Finn. You remember Francis Finn, who was one of the original arrivals at Port Natal, which
yes,
became Durban.
Yes, interesting.
And the Finns were called the White Zulus. And, of course, Sia's other side of his family is completely Zulu, but the Finns...
Sallow, yeah.
I mean, yeah, so... and isn't that interesting? Because we so often see things in silos and we imagine, well, you know, that if you are black, these must be your ancestors, and if you're white, these must be your ancestors. But there is intermingling of that in this country to a huge degree.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the Duke of Westminster, the late Duke of Westminster, he died recently, who's a fourth cousin of mine, with the Viscount Cobham, I think he's the 11th or the 12th Viscount Cobham, and the Queen's cousin, Patrick Lichfield's children, because his wife was a Grosvenor, which means from the Westminster line, all descend, they're my fourth cousins, all descend from a girl called Angela of Bengal, a blue-eyed Indian.
Itself sounds like it's meant to be a novel.
But don't forget, she was called Moy Ansela was the ancestress, Pretty Angela in the Cape. We've got record of her in the Cape from 1654. We don't know whether she was brought in as a companion of one of the explorers or adventurers or traders or merchants who stopped off at the Cape in those days, or if she was just taken off the beach and created as a lover. She became a very prominent property owner and trader in the Cape, Moy Ansela, Angela of Bengal. And her daughter, one of her three daughters, was a girl called Anna de Kooning, which is an Afrikaanderization of de Koning. He was from Ghent, interesting enough, talking about John of Gaunt, John of Ghent. And she was a very prominent woman. Now, her line through the Le Sieur family, and the Westminsters and myself are all fourth cousins. If you've met my father, he's even more Aryan looking than I am, with his fair hair and blue eyes and fair skin. There'd be no record at all of this blood. But why was she blue-eyed? The portrait at least indicates that her daughter was blue-eyed. That may have come from de Kooning, but I have seen records that she was blue-eyed. Well, because the Crusades who went across during the 1100s, of course, were cross-pollinating with the people
in the Middle East,
Persia and India.
Yeah.
Right?
And further. And then even before that, Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great.
Which is why you have people in certain parts of Afghanistan.
Blue-eyed Arabs.
Who look like they should come from Yugoslavia.
You get blue-eyed, a very high percentage of the Maharajas of India are blue-eyed. But it's not in the genus of the Indian people to have blue eyes. And this would come from the fact that there was a cross-pollination which has continued through the ages.
Now, you've done lots of interesting things, Conrad. One of the things that you've been quite involved in that I wanted to quickly mention, because I think it's important, is that the Rand Club here in Johannesburg is an old institution, and it was it looked like it was in some financial trouble a while ago. Ben, you've been there for dinner a couple of times, right?
That's where I recognize you from. You stand at the entrance there, picking up young ladies.
Of course. God, you've got me caught in one sentence. You've put me exactly in my place.
So what happened? Because it's still there, it's healthy, and it's doing well, but it wasn't in this position a couple of years ago.
What happened was that the club ran out of money. The membership dropped from... I think it was 1,750 members down to 195 active members. Wow. An active member is somebody who would probably go to the club once a month, maybe really active members once a week. But with the exodus out of the old CBD, the membership or the attendance dropped. Parking was perceived to be a problem. The operating costs were too high, and they had to sadly close the club, which was done. The doors were shut. Wonderful, wonderful, loyal, fantastic staff who were like family to us inside the doors of the club had to be paid off, all obviously properly done, legally done. Everything was done according to the statute. I wasn't involved in any of that. I became involved after the club had been mothballed. They said, well, now we must try and find a way forward. There was a potential hotel who wanted to come in and do a deal with us, and at the last minute they backed out. And Rick Curry and I, and a chap called Professor Ramsey Briley, who I think runs the mechanical engineering faculty at WITS,
mm-hmm.
All decided to get together. This is after I had heard what Professor Briley was trying to do with some sort of a business model, and we needed some funds to put up to replace a loan by an anonymous lender, who very gracious anonymous lender put up money saying, here's 5 million rand interest-free for a year. After that, we'll have to register a mortgage. And we were suddenly worried that this anonymous lender, who, although we knew his or her very generous and magnanimous gesture was well-meaning, there was a risk that the property could go to that unknown entity after a year, because there was going to be no way that the loan could be repaid. So I formed a thing called the Rand Club Salvage Consortium, RCSC, including a number of very fine young men who Ramsey Briley had been working on with. He had a thing called the Young Members Think Tank.
Mm-hmm.
We got together, some funds were put up, a little bit more than the 5 million to repay the loan on time and leave a bit of cash flow in the till to keep it going.
And the business model has worked.
We were given 6 months, a 6 month trial period to make it work. We got involved with a group called Masiwela, who were to do the catering. We changed the model from being that of a club to being that of a venue. It's one of the most beautiful, iconic buildings in the country, without any question. We saw ourselves as fathers of the city that we had a duty to keep it going. My father and grandfather were members, as were Richard Curry's grandfather and father. And in fact, his grandfather's uncle was also a member.
Hmm.
We felt we had a duty to let out this beautiful venue for money, but done in such a way that this income would subsidize the value of the operating costs, or subsidize the actual cost to a point that would be viable for members to still enjoy the facility. So we've had some very big dues there.
And you've managed to save it. It seems to be working.
Standard Bank had their annual due there in December, which was a great event. And Mutual and Federal released their annual results recently for, I think, about 200 people in the morning. So they pay for the venue. Doesn't upset the functionality of the club. They all have in a lovely building. The catering is now undertaken by Mussie Weller, so the club no longer caters. We have no waiters or caterers or anybody serving drinks. It's all done by the catering and events management group, and the model so far seems to be working. We may still fail. I can't guarantee. We may still fail, but so far we've passed the initial 6 month, was the end of February.
I just think that it's really important in a country where we talk about how we want to improve things and we want to keep things going, we want to maintain things, that there are private citizens who are going to the trouble of doing exactly that. And this, very, very few people talk about them. So
this building would have fallen into disrepair in no time.
Mm.
We've already spent a fortune on essential repairs, waterproofing and critical stuff, burst water
but
pipes and
I
so
want
on.
To move on to something else. Mm. You've also built you've grown the biggest maze in the Southern Hemisphere.
Mm.
A maze, like, you know, when you run into a labyrinth, see ya?
Amazing.
And you have to turn, you know, a maze. You have to turn left and right and you get lost in it. And you built the biggest maze in the Southern Hemisphere.
Correct.
Why?
Where I always wanted a maze. I always wanted a maze.
Interesting. How big is this?
It's 6,000 square meters. That's an acre and a half.
Planted all the trees.
Planted all the trees. There were six rond a tree when I planted it 21 years ago. The trees was I bought them bulk 1,100 or 1,200 trees, 1,400 trees. I've forgotten the exact number.
Mm.
Planted them 1 meter apart. And there was six rond a tree.
So how big are they now?
They're now 4 meters high. In fact, we have to lop off the tops. We've been doing that every year, not for the last couple of years. But now that it's got so high, the grass in between the hedgerow is dying due to lack of sunlight. So this June, which is the time to do it, we'll be doing it again. There's a thing called the Toscana aphid, which is an aphid that comes in. And when you see the foliage turning brown, it's already too late, because what they do is they suck all the sap out and then excrete a highly toxic, acidic feces or urine.
Poison. I'm not
it's a poison, which goes right down to the stem of the tree, and that whole branch is dead. And by the time you see that, it's too late. So we've been doing spraying, but we have to do it with caution because the spraying kills the ladybirds that eats the aphid. We don't want to kill the ladybirds. Now the Israelis have found a particular wasp which comes in, and it plants its seeds, its eggs, into the little aphids. And then when the eggs grow, the aphids pop. So this is a marvelous way of dealing with the problem. We've been alternating between, I don't know what the term is, but we've been feeding the roots every alternate year and spraying every alternate year just to try and look after the, you know, nature. But we attract a lot of birds and other life because of the maize. It's a very interesting thing. This is a chart wall.
And you've written some songs.
God, is this an interview?
Well, come on.
Is this a character interview?
Well, I'm just there. Yes, you're an interesting man.
Interesting things.
What sort of songs? Wow.
Well, more the lyrics. And I have written a bit of music. Not that I can write scores, but I would whistle a tune to somebody with a piano and they'd then follow it through and I'd say, change it here and change it there. And then I'd get it recorded, the actual music, the scores recorded. And then make a piece of music out of it.
Wow.
So when I was a boy, at the age of about 2.5, I think, I used to sing on the radio for Percy Banishek on Thursday mornings. And my father got all high-handed and said, the pennies don't entertain other people. So I was whipped off the stage and put into the choir at St. Martin's in the Veld in Rosebank. Is it called a cassock? I think it's called a cassock.
What is it, choir boy?
Yes. So that's what happened to my interest in music as a boy.
I'm sorry, Conrad. That sounds like a sad story.
No, it's not sad at all. And that's why when I got to 50, I thought, to hell with this. I better just try and make a bit of music.
Yes.
You know, and to hell with whether it's entertaining other people or not. So I did it. It wasn't, I've learned enough about music now to be critical of my own music and say, although it was very pleasant, it wasn't good enough, in my opinion. I'm not talking of my voice as a singer. The actual composition, I think, is very good. It was a brass band march that I wrote the scores for, or had the scores written, by a chap called, he was then Captain Matthijs Pienaar. He's now Colonel Matthijs Pienaar of the SA Air Force Brass Band. It's very nice music. Maybe one day Gareth will play it. It's damn good music, I think.
Well, I've always you tell terrific stories, and I've always thought that it's probably better to be one of those people who at least tries all the things that you're interested in and tries to learn about all the things that you're interested in than to live your life being expert in one field and never really develop anything else.
The only thing you can take to your grave are your fantasies, and you want to live out your fantasies before they outlive you.
That's powerful stuff.
Yeah. And of course, my children and grandchildren and my dear wife are my biggest asset, despite all the other stuff of chocolate.
Well, you keep telling all of us, you keep telling everyone to breed.
Yes, that's
to have
quite
more
right.
children.
That's quite right.
So this is an obsession. We don't have an option, according to Conrad. We all have to breed.
Correct.
All right. So thank you, Conrad Penny.
So just one last thing. Thank you, Gareth, for the interview.
Sure.
One last thing. Just, I didn't want to make it sound as if the reinterment was not a grand affair. It was a huge affair.
No. I think you've made it.
Absolutely huge
affair. Just, it wasn't of the standard.
It was deliberately played down,
I
think, by special instruction.
Well, we'll have to find out.
But it was grand enough.
What a fascinating
story. The truth
story.
Will out on Richard.
Yeah.
If this information we're putting together comes to anything worthwhile, and I want, as I say, the reader to make the decision as to whether or not he was a villain, I think once the truth is out, he will be exonerated. And that's my quest at the moment.
And a hunchback? Was he a hunchback?
He had scoliosis. He had scoliosis because apparently his gestation period in his mother's womb was longer than normal. He developed scoliosis. He did not have a funny arm, as had been proven by his bones. And in fact, when you see the way he was buried in Leicester, he was unceremoniously buried. His body was crouched and slouched. They didn't even bother to dig the damn hole properly.
Poor man.
Dreadful.
What a way to die.
I'm quite sure with what we have available, if we don't exonerate him, he's going to turn out to be a much nicer person than history has so far proved him to be.
Thank you, Conrad.
Thank you, Gary.
Lovely to have you here. It's 5 minutes to nine. Here's what you need to know to end this morning's show and to hand over to the Unview. All right, so listen to this. The Queen has ordered an emergency meeting of all her staff. They've been summoned to Buckingham Palace for an announcement that's said to be a mystery, even to those closest to her. Speculation is rife, however, that someone dropped a giant turd. And as Philip is too old to produce such a big, proud piece of excrement, the Queen is looking to leave no stone unturned in finding the culprit and then going medieval on their backsides. The Weeknd's dad has pitched up out of nowhere this past week. The Weeknd, of course, the singer. After abandoning the artist when he was just 12 years old, he's played no part in his life or his rise to fame. This deadbeat dad says he doesn't want any money or anything like that. He just wants to listen to his son's music. Ideally, he wants to listen to his son's music in a giant mansion with fast cars, which his son could perhaps pay for. And finally, Andy Murray says the Grand Slams don't really need the attention that Maria Sharapova brings. Murray says Sharapova was about an 8 in her day. Now she's no more than a sympathetic 6. Eugenie Bouchard, though, the lanky Scot, reckons she's a solid 9 and hopes she could go far this year on the court. And we will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have an excellent day in the company of CliffCentral.com.